All right, open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Monday, March 16th. We'll go a little bit out of order here. Let's open the work session on Senate Bill 438. Jim?
Senate Bill 438 is your credit unions bill. It defines organization purpose of determining credit union membership. It increases maximum loans they may be made by credit union to members of the credit union's management team. And it increases the amount of fidelity bond required of the credit unions. You have the Dash 2 amendment, which has some technical language requiring that a credit manager who is appointed in lieu of credit committee be appointed by the credit union board of directors.
Okay, because as I recall, we weren't sure that we actually needed the Dash 1 in the first place. So why don't we ask Pam Levitt to come forward and David Tapman, DCBS, had it wanted to make a comment on the amendment. Let's see, first of all, whether we need this amendment or not. So we need whether we need to amend the amendment. Or whether we can just be amenable to the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. After reviewing and having a few discussions with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we did determine that we needed the Dash 2, which incorporates all of the Dash 1 plus an additional change. Hal Scoggins, who is the attorney for the Credit Union Association of Oregon, will just briefly tell you about the Dash 2.
Okay. Hal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Wada Witt. We are the outside counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. And just briefly, there are five things that these Dash 2 amendments do, and they are all what I would call in the nature of technical clarifications. Really, some of them were brought about by some stylistic changes that legislative counsel made in drafting the bill. Originally, the first change is it deals with the issue of the required bond amount, and in the very first category of the required bond amount, it's not clear which applies, the minimum or the maximum, and when, and we simply add whichever is less to make it clear that it is the lesser of those two amounts that applies. The second change clarifies the issue regarding field of membership, the required things that you have to prove in order to establish a geographic field of membership, and we're simply changing a single interaction to multiple interactions to make it clear that there are likely and that the DCBS can consider multiple interactions among the people that make up a community. Again, very, very minor, very technical, but it's probably a good idea to do. The third change is related to the issue that Mr. Stembridge spoke about just now, and that is the requirement for a credit committee versus a credit manager, and we want to make it clear, and the wording as it was left it slightly unclear, that it's a sort of an either-or proposition. You either have a credit committee that's elected or you have a credit manager that is appointed by the board. Just clarifying that that's the case. Fourth change is we are making it clear that if a quorum of the board of directors is present at the annual meeting of the members, that satisfies the requirement for a monthly meeting of the board of directors for that particular month. That was the intent of the original language, but as long as we're doing an amendment, we wanted to be sure that we're absolutely clear on that point. And finally, an issue that we've discussed with the DCBS is the limit on loans to officials, which was one of the changes that we made in this particular bill, clarifying the limit that the board of directors has to approve loans above that limit for specified officials. In the process of drafting, there is a limit in there that says that all the loans to all of those individuals can't exceed 10% of the credit union's assets. In the drafting process, that got moved to make it look like that only applied to one individual, and that in fact is the limit that applies to all. So this amendment goes back and puts that limit back to the way that it was, which was the intent from the beginning.
Thank you. Mr. Tapman, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is David Tapman, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And among our many responsibilities is the oversight and regulation of state chartered credit unions in Oregon. Mr. Scoggins and Ms. Leavitt have already confirmed that we've discussed these matters. I've asked to have my testimony handed out, and that last issue that Mr. Scoggins touched on is a point of clarification in our testimony. It was our understanding that that limitation on the loans to officers and directors would be limited for all officers and directors and not to a single one, and so we appreciate seeing that changed in the dash twos. The other reason I'm here is we want just to clarify, if you will put on the record, that it is our understanding that the changes to provided in the bill would include a definition of organizations, and that would be businesses, entities, and so forth that are within a credit union's community if they're community chartered. We're perfectly fine with defining that. We think that's great. We also understand that one of the concerns that credit unions have is that they're based on relationships. And many of these credit unions that are now community charters started out as occupational credit unions. In other words, that people who shared a common occupation came together to form these credit unions, and they like to retain that occupational relationship, even though they've moved on to the community. So we're supportive of this notion of allowing those who made up the original occupational basis for a credit union to continue to have the ability to use that credit union, regardless of whether they are so employed within the community or outside the community. For example, should a Safeway store make up an original credit union that was an occupational one and they went to a community charter? Under this concept, that Safeway store, members of the employees of that store, even though they're not within the current community, could still be members of the credit union. With that understanding, we think that's a great idea. We would probably want to make sure everything's clarified through rule preparation or rule writing and rulemaking, and we would work with the Credit Union Association of Oregon to do just that should this bill pass. And with that, I conclude my testimony. I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Mr. Chapman, first of all, in your testimony, you talk about a desire on page 6, line 20, to mention the aggregate of loans to all officers and directors.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And that's encompassed in our dash 2?
Correct.
Okay. Okay. We had heard this bill last week, colleagues, and the only reason we didn't move work session there is Mr. Yates gave him the courtesy in case he found anything he wanted to, and have not heard back from him if there was any issues. So
we're ready,
I think, with the dash 2.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 438.
Senator Starrs moved the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 438. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 438 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 438 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I'll go ahead and carry that bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 438. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 101. And we'll go to the able Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 101 requires the State Department of Energy to establish greenhouse gas emission performance standard for electric generating facilities. It limits the maximum emissions of greenhouse gas, the standard, to no more than that from combined cycle natural gas generation. It prohibits electricity providers from entering into long-term financial commitments for electricity produced by a non-complying generating facility, and it also makes legislative findings on greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay. Let's start us off with Mike Greeny from the Department of Energy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Greeny, Director of the Department of Energy, and with me is Lee Sparling from the Public Utility Commission. Thank you for hearing our bill. Senate Bill 101 is part of the governor's climate change package. It establishes an emission performance standard for power plants, and it's complementary to the cap and trade legislation and other legislation that's in the climate change package. Specifically, it sets a standard for emissions of greenhouse gases from power plants, either that are new power plants in Oregon or power plants under either new power plants or new arrangements of power plants serving Oregon load in the future. And the standard is the equivalent of a natural gas power plant, so the intent is to avoid increasing reliance on coal in the future, both for this, the greenhouse gas emissions, and by reducing our reliance on coal, there are also other environmental benefits as well, although the emission performance standards are focused on greenhouse gases. This is an important tool to help also meet the greenhouse gas reduction goals of House Bill 3543 that was established last session, or passed last session, that sets targets for reducing our greenhouse gases with targets in the year 2020 and also by the year 2050. The emission standard would be administered by Department of Energy and Public Utility Commission. Public Utility Commission for investor-owned utilities and independent energy service providers, and Department of Energy with respect to consumer-owned utilities. The bill also includes two other provisions that clarifies that carbon sequestration systems are energy facilities for purposes of review and siting by the Energy Facility Siting Council. And it also updates the standard that the Siting Council has for exempting from the siting process efficient cogeneration facilities that are based on their output of greenhouse gases. The emission performance standard concept has been adopted in Washington and California, and the standard that they've adopted is essentially the same in terms of general approach, namely the standard being the emissions of a natural gas power plant that we're proposing here. Having said that, let me mention that quite a bit of work still needs to be done on the bill. This is a complicated area. We've had general interest and support from utilities for the concept, but we've had extended discussions with utilities, both investor-owned and consumer-owned, as well as citizens groups like the Citizens Utility Board and others on the details and clarification of responsibilities between Department of Energy and the PUC, for example. As drafted, the bill didn't reflect what we had intended going in. We mentioned a couple of other issues that we're dealing with. There's interest in our bill following more closely either the California or the Washington approach. Unfortunately, the California and Washington approach didn't follow each other. They went in two different directions, so we're having to work through which issues we follow one or the other on there. Also, the role of the publicly owned utilities, and this came up in the adoption of the Renewable Portfolio Standard last session, that so long as those utilities did not make major commitments for new commitments for coal, they were exempt from most of the requirements of the Renewable Portfolio Standard. That approach, I think, should work in this case as well. There's some details on the actual language that needs to be adopted to make that work here. There's also questions of how much should be in the specific statute versus delegating to the agencies to do through rulemakings. And again, part of that is depending on whether we follow the California approach or the Washington approach. There was more detail in the Washington bill than there was in the California bill, and those are issues that we're having discussions on as well. With the chair's indulgence, we'd like some additional time. I'd hoped that we would have amendments wrapped up by now, ready for the committee, but we do need a little more time to work on these with the other parties. Notice you have quite a few people who signed up, and they'll probably want to talk in some detail on their specific issues.
Thank you. Mr. Barley, do you have anything to add? Or we probably will have questions. I'm going to ask if there's any right now, but I think more of them will evolve after we have additional testimony. But as we start, is there any immediate questions for Mr. Graney? And we'll have him available for questions as we go through.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Berger.
Mr. Graney, I appreciate your testimony. I guess that I have a criticism of our looking to California or Washington for leadership. I hear that too much, and I think Oregon is unique, and I think Oregonians are well postured to make decisions for Oregon, and so I'd just like to offer that criticism.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, Senator Burge, if I can just add to that. I agree with you. I think the interest here is to the extent that we have utilities working in more than one state, that to the extent that it makes sense to be similar or complementary, if not identical, then we should look for those opportunities. But I agree with you 100%.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Starr.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Green, for your testimony. Are you going to provide written testimony for us? I'd love to have your comments in front of me.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, we can do that. I didn't have them prepared for today, but I'll be glad to do that.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to step back just a little bit and ask you the kind of a question is, why do we have to move on this at this time? If Washington and California are already going forward, to see what the impact would be on their businesses, because energy prices are down right now, but if they start to go back up, this could be a very expensive mandate on our ratepayers. I was wondering, is there any reason that we can't see what the impact is on Washington and California before we walk down this same path that could put all of our manufacturing businesses in huge jeopardy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, we certainly could take that approach. I guess I don't think it's necessary in this case because, this is not an industry-wide or statewide cap-and-trade program that applies to everybody. This is just apply to power plants, and I think it's actually not only complementary to a potential cap-and-trade program, but it's complementary to the policy decisions you made in 2007 on the renewable portfolio standard. And all our indications are that rates have not risen because of that bill. And I think it's quite possible that with the encouragement of renewable energy and continued use of natural gas, that rates would not rise more than they would have otherwise with this bill. I think we have on the possible horizon a likely federal action to reduce carbon, and that could take the form of carbon taxes in addition to any other limitations. And by reducing our reliance on future coal, I think it actually strengthens us economically in terms of potential impacts on ratepayers and consumers.
Can I do a follow-up real quick?
Sure.
Let me give you a scenario. So you go through and you say, we're not going to sign any new contracts with anybody who produces from coal, which is domestically probably our biggest. The U.S. is our biggest source of energy. It would be coal-fired plants. So we're going to take that off the table for our ratepayers to be able to access that power. So let's say, for instance, that we're wrong on this.
Mm-hmm.
And how quickly could we reverse that policy to get it so that our ratepayers could somehow get some relief when power rates do go back up, because they will.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, you could revisit it to every session, you know, next legislative session, if that were necessary.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. I will mention, though, just one thing, as you'll probably find from our committee, is our committee is loath to put much into rule. They like things in statute as much as possible. So as we kind of go through that bill, keep that in mind.
That will be helpful, guys.
I think you'll find that from the folks here.
Thank you
very much. We'll probably have some more questions later. What I want to do, so we can get the right table set here, I'm going to go next with the people who are impacted by this, and then we'll go to the public comment on it. So Scott Bolden of PacifiCorp, Brenda McCarthy of PGE, and Tom O'Connor. Let's start with the three of you. Get some context here for our discussion.
Sure.
And I'll let you guys decide who gets to go first.
Flip the coin and I'll go first.
Okay.
For the record, Scott Bolton with PacifiCorp. As many of you may know, PacifiCorp serves six states. We're an integrated utility across the West. We have about 1.7 million customers across the six states, and about 550,000 that we serve as Pacific Power here in Oregon. We're no stranger to the concept of emissions performance standards. PacifiCorp was engaged, I believe it was in 2006, when California first adopted an emissions performance standard, and then in the 2007 session worked with other utilities and customer stakeholders in Washington on their emissions performance standards. So this is really kind of our third try at this, and we've learned a lot of lessons along the way. We do support at least the concept behind Senate Bill 101 at this time. As you've heard from Director Graney, there is a broad cross-section of utilities and customer groups and environmental organizations working together now to try to come up with consensus amendments as to how Oregon's emissions performance standard would work. We support it for two reasons. The first is currently there is a lot of uncertainty over carbon risk and whether or not the whether it's the states or the nation's climate change policies will support new unsequestered carbon coal plants. That uncertainty collides with our investment plans as we go into the Public Utilities Commission and try to map out our resource strategy for 20, 30, 50 years ahead to meet our customers' needs. Oregon is a least cost, least risk planning state, meaning that we're supposed to bring in the cheapest and least risky energy. And today, because we don't know what that carbon regulatory framework will be, it's very difficult to assess the risk. So what emissions performance standards such as Senate Bill 101 offer is some bright line certainty as to which technologies and which resources we should be investing in to meet customer needs and which ones we cannot. We've supported legislation along this line in California and Washington. We do very much desire having consistency across the states that we serve. We do bring in our resources on an allocated basis, so the power plants that we serve Oregon with are also the same power plants that we serve our customers in California and Washington, so certainly our customers are advantaged by consistency in policy across those state lines where it can be achieved. I'll go ahead before I hand it over to my colleague from PG. I just wanted to say the other item in Senate Bill 101 that we're encouraged by and what I think is another reason for a utility such as mine to support the bill is that it does acknowledge that there will be technological changes, that we at least do not believe that coal is forever off the table, but there do have to be some advances in how we deal with the carbon emissions that do currently come from coal-fired plant technologies. And so it does lead us down a path of how would the state of Oregon treat new technologies like IGCC, which is integrated gasification, combined cycle. So how do you turn coal into gas and then find ways to deal with the carbon emissions that result? We think that's a positive step. Does recognize that we do need not just policy changes, but certainly technological changes to try and reduce the emissions associated with electricity production.
Mr. Bolton, I've got a question for you. It was brought up by Mr. Graney, or alluded to by Mr. Graney. Could you tell us what the primary differences are in the California slash Washington slash Oregon approach? Because both of us talked about how this is similar, but there are differences. Could you tell me what the key differences are? Because you're talking about certainty, and obviously Cal and Washington are a little bit different. This is, seems to be a tweener. Can you tell me what the major differences are between this legislation as written and what you deal with regulatory environment on this issue in Cal and Washington's legislation?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to. California, as I said, was the first state in the nation to pass an emissions performance standard, and it pretty much just did that. No new coal. Agencies go figure out how to implement that. And so California did undertake a very thorough, detailed rulemaking, both with their California Energy Commission and with their Public Utilities Commission, to figure out how to make that work and implement that policy that the legislature passed. I think in the spirit of taking lessons learned and applying them forward, when Washington brought legislation about a year and a half later, we were able to take those lessons learned. So what exactly is the emissions threshold that you would look at? Those types of technical issues that were discovered in the California rulemaking, we were able to discuss with the legislature up in Olympia and talk about, this is where California landed. You could save yourself a lot of time and money by just taking the lessons and the work that's already been done. And that's what the Washington legislature did. So the Washington bill, Senate Bill 6001, that was passed in 2007, is much more detailed. It kind of gets to the conclusion of a lot of the questions that were initially asked when California addressed the issue. Now that we're here in 2009 in Oregon, we certainly don't want to abdicate leadership on issues of energy or climate policy, but certainly where some of the technical aspects, such as, you know, what are the ambient heat rates that combined cycle gas plants operate at what elevations, and how to assign emissions to those. It makes a lot of sense that we have some standardization across the states that wish to adopt these kinds of policies.
And then Mr. Greeny also pointed out this is part of a package of bills on greenhouse gases, and specifically mentioned the cap and trade bill, Senate Bill 80, which has exactly the same relating clause as this bill. Is what relationship do you see as the regulated utility between those two issues? Which is the other, of course, bill is in Senator Dingfelder's committee, so I'm trying to get a relationship understanding between this policy embedded in 101 and Senate Bill 80.
Chairman Metzger, I think, personally speaking, the way I would address that is an emissions performance standard really deals with new resources, whether it's building a new plant from the ground up or it's acquiring a new interest or contract in an existing plant. It's what are the allowable emissions associated with the power that we procure to serve our customers with. Policies such as cap and trade or Senate Bill 80 deal more with what do we do with the existing portfolio? How do we treat the emissions associated with the power that customers already consume? And what's the proper way to realize a carbon price, or how would you penalize or discourage going over a certain threshold of emissions associated with that power? So we do see Senate Bill 101 as a complementary measure. We see this as yet one more plank in developing a strategy for emissions reduction, because this will tell my company as an investor in these resources what types of technologies are inbound and which ones are out. Cap and trade policies, it's a different animal in our book.
Okay. Sorry about doing that. I broke it up. I'll go to the next two, and then we'll ask the panel the questions. Mr. McCarthy from PG.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Brendan McCarthy. I'm here representing PGE. PGE, as you know, is a fully integrated utility serving over 800,000 customers over a 4,000 square mile service territory, mostly in the northern Willamette Valley and environs. Generally speaking, I just want to make my comments very short and sweet. We've been working with this group, a coalition of other utilities and consumer groups in the PUC and the department, to come to some consensus. We think we're fairly close. There are just a few technical issues left that we want to hammer out. We think we can probably get there this week, we think we can probably support the bill at that point in time.
Okay, Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Tom O'Connor, representing Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. Our folks are willing to go along with an emissions performance standard that would effectively prohibit new long-term contracts for coal that is not sequestered. Our two chief concerns, and we have been part of this working group and will continue to be, our two chief concerns are that it be a clear, bright line in statute that directs our elected officials and our local boards in terms of the decision parameters that they can make. Two, that it incorporates the language in ORS 469A, 0.005, which is the RPS, regarding our Bonneville contracts. The background for that is that our emissions are, of course, currently very low. We already have in the RPS, we agreed to last session in the compromise language, a de facto prohibition on new long-term contracts for coal. That language in the RPS says if the small utilities were to enter into a new long-term contract for coal, they would automatically pop into the highest renewable resource standard, the 25%. That is a clear direction to us not to enter into long-term coal contracts. So our interest is making sure that we don't get whipsawed between two standards here, that we bring the language in from the existing ORS as part of this, and, as I say again, incorporate a clear, bright line in statute so that we can make the kind of investments in contracts that we'll need to make in the future. And we are part of the working group, and we're pretty close. We think we're pretty close to that.
Questions from the committee for any of these folks? Senator George.
Gentlemen, I understand your interest is figuring out what you should build based under the law, and then you add your margin on top of it. But the question that we've got to ask for all of our ratepayers is, what is the additional cost of this piece of legislation? Because you guys are just simply the middleman, I mean, if I'm not correct. You simply say, what did it cost us to get the power? Here's our margin. Here's our delivery system. And that's the price the ratepayer pays. So I understand why you guys want a bright line. But who then watches out for the actual cost of the ratepayers, and how much of an additional cost are we talking about? If you compare a coal-fired plant with, say, wind energy or a wave energy kilowatt, what kind of price differentials are we talking about here? Because that's really the question that we have to ask ourselves.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll take a shot at that. Chair Metzger, Senator George. Maybe to answer that a little bit backwards, on the price issue, I think right now if you were to look at just the cost of generation side by side, you would find that coal is a cheaper resource. What we can't cost out right now, and one of the reasons why I think utilities are looking for that bright line guidance, policy guidance as to what resources are in or out, is the fact that we can't right now cost out what exactly carbon risk is. How much is there going to be as far as a federal carbon tax or a cap and trade system or other types of direct regulation of emissions? That's the X factor right now, and one of the reasons why even absent an emissions performance standard, you probably aren't going to see a lot of new investment in traditional coal-fired technologies because of that uncertainty. So this at least provides some certainty. Hopefully it's a bridge till we get that national framework policy as to how carbon is going to be treated. Then an emissions performance standard really isn't necessary.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
So I guess my next question to you is that what percentage is coal currently? What percentage would coal be without any threat of federal action? And what are we talking, and where would we make these percentages up? I mean, obviously we're removing dams. We have lawsuits against our wave energy facilities on the Oregon coast. We have geothermal plants being blocked in the Newberry crater by environmental regulations. We've got all of these things. So where do we get this energy? I mean, if not for every option being on the table.
Go ahead, Tom.
Senator George, Mr. Chair, Senator George, Tom O'Connor, there's no question that this narrows the options. For us, again, I think we're in a little bit different situation. Our existing resource mix is overwhelmingly hydro and nuclear, small amount of wind. We buy our power from Bonneville. And Bonneville is constrained by the Regional Power Act of 1980, the Power Planning Council's plan, and frankly, the national direction is pretty clear. So looking to the future, we've got to face, similar to what Scott said, the issue of this being an uncertain future about what resources are available. We don't know what the carbon price is going to be. I think one of the critical things to us would be, again, as Scott referred to, that this would be a bridge, not the final answer. This does give us some certainty for the interim until we have a overall national, emphasize national, not state, carbon reduction mechanism in place. Then we've got an ability to look at more answers. Natural gas, this puts a lot of emphasis on natural gas. There's no question about it. Renewables are clearly a direction we're going, but as you know, they have to be backed up by something, and that's going to be gas. Gas can be volatile in price. There are no easy real answers on this one. We think that this is, again, as a temporary bridge, combined with programs around energy efficiency and some other things, a way that we can at least provide some certainty to our folks, but as a temporary bridge, not the final answer.
I guess the only thing that I would add, Chair Metzger and Senator George, is that it is another layer of regulation that we have to be mindful of. We think, though, with as long as we carefully structure it, we protect our existing contracts, our existing ownership interests that are out there already. We treat this as not specifically as a carbon reduction bill by itself, but as a no new coal bill. We can get there as far as what my resource planning people tell me.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Stuart, is it Leibowitz and Diane Polly Sterling? So, Polly or Stuart, who's our third person up here?
Diane. I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay. Let's start off.
Okay. As a member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition...
Please state your name for the record.
Oh, yes. Stuart Leibowitz. I'm from Roseburg, Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
As a member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, a grassroots organization dedicated to finding solutions to global warming, I strongly urge you to support Senate Bill 101. Based on the most recent report of the International Panel on Climate Change, we have already condemned future generations to dire consequences of global warming. Assuming we act now, we can limit carbon dioxide levels to 450 parts per million. This will still mean a billion people around the globe suffering from a shortage of water, as well as an increase in sea levels and flooding. Coal, by far, is the primary contributor to global warming pollutants in the utility sector, and it releases the most carbon dioxide per energy unit of any fossil fuel. Scientists at NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies state that we can stay under the level of 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide only if we eliminate all coal plant emissions by 2030. It is a formidable task, but one which we must start now. For 20 years, we debated the reality of global warming with the polluters of industry. For 20 years, we failed to act, waiting for another city to go first, another state to go first, another country to go first. And as a result, we have passed the tipping point and are now faced with the unenviable task of stopping the catastrophic from becoming the unthinkable. As in the past, you may hear warnings of the economic consequences of passing global warming legislation. However, Eco Northwest, an economic consulting firm, estimates climate change will cost Oregon over $3 billion per year by 2020. But the impact of climate change cannot be measured solely by an entry on a ledger or viewed through an accountant's lens. For what price is acceptable for the displacement of people due to rising seas or the possible extinction of 30% of all species? Oregon can join California and Washington in establishing a clean energy corridor for the West Coast. If other states have not yet joined us, then we must lead. Our generation bears a tremendous responsibility for the climate crisis and a profound obligation to future generations to leave a legacy of a livable planet. Senate Bill 101 is a significant step toward meeting this challenge, and I urge passage of this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Diane Phillips, and I'm also a board member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, and I am director of Oregon Citizens Against the Pipeline, which is in Douglas County, although I'm here to talk for myself. While the changes needed to combat global warming will be challenging to our society and will come with some economic sacrifice, the result of doing nothing to counteract climate change is as unimaginable as the predicted consequences of rising temperatures on our economic welfare and the livability of our state. However, great economic opportunity can also come from implementing the next steps toward a sustainable future, especially if similar policies are adopted by nearby states. California has already passed its version of Senate Bill 101 by adopting a performance standard for energy facilities. Oregon needs to follow suit or lead. If we are going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to Oregon's targeted goals of 10% below 1990 levels by 2020 or 70% below 1990 levels by 2050, we must regulate utilities' long-term energy commitments. Senate Bill 101 does that in a very comprehensive and logical way. It sets up a performance standard that is no higher than the rate of emissions of greenhouse gases from combined cycle natural gas generating facilities for all energy either produced or consumed in Oregon. It also defines generating facilities as any facility that produces no more than 25 megawatts of energy from a thermal energy source, a combustion turbine plant, a nuclear facility, a large transmission line, a large transmission pipeline, a synthetic fuel plant, a large biomass plant, or an underground storage facility of no more than 50 million cubic feet. In adopting a performance standard, Senate Bill 101 takes into account energy reliability and overall cost to electric customers. It has a provision for grandfathering existing combined cycle natural gas generating facilities that are not expanding operations and that are in operation on June 30th, 2009, or received a site certificate on or before June 30th, 2009. The bill also excludes hydroelectric facilities. Oregon is taking the necessary steps towards implementing a sustainable energy policy with greenhouse gas reduction targets that are appropriate. Senate Bill 101 is a necessary next step if we're going to truly make effective change in reducing the consequences of global warming. I'm here today to say that Senate Bill 101 has my support, and I believe it is a well-thought-out legislation that deserves your support, too. However, I do have some suggested changes to the bill. First, when talking about combined cycle natural gas, I would suggest the source of natural gas be either domestically produced or produced in Canada. The life cycle of natural gas imported as LNG from overseas has a much higher greenhouse gas life cycle and should not be used as a standard. Second, when defining a nuclear incident or nuclear occurrence, the definition must also include discharge or dispersal of or human and property damage from source material from its intended source on-site as well as off-site. On-site accidents can also have dire and long-lasting consequences. Thirdly, I suggest the definition of nuclear power plant be changed to any nuclear power producing facility with a nominal electric generating capacity of not only more than 25 megawatts, but also to include facilities that produce less than 25 megawatts. All nuclear facilities must fall under the regulation of this legislation. As you can see, I have major reservations on nuclear energy development and the implications of promoting that technology. In saying that, I thank you very much for your time, and let's get behind Senate Bill 101. Our future and the future of our children and grandchildren depend on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Polly Sterling. I live in Roseburg, Oregon, and I'm also a member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. And as you've heard from previous testimony, the effects of coal on emissions are very damaging to our environment and for future consequences of global warming. we have a choice to take action now or to wait and have to pay a higher cost for dealing with these problems. Just last week at a meeting in Denmark, which is a preliminary to next December's meeting to move ahead from where the Kyoto Agreement left off, scientists reported that we are moving much faster towards the consequences of global warming than we even thought were possible 2 years ago. To deal with this, we have to realize that we do have costs to pay. But what we have here with Senate Bill 101, we will find that if we fail to adopt this standard, we will have more drastic actions to take later, and the costs will be higher, not only in economic terms, but also in the social and health problems that accompany this. So I encourage your support of Senate Bill 101 as a very important first step in moving toward new energy options for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for any of our guests? Senator George.
Thank you. I'm trying to get an idea from the three of you. If we eliminate coal as a possibility, and obviously just for the button, I can see LNG is off the table also as far as expanding it, then you're concerned about nuclear. Right now we're ripping out dams on the Klamath Basin, and there's efforts to rip down other hydro plants. We've got lawsuits filed against wave energy facilities on the Oregon coast. We've got land use laws blocking geothermal plants in around Newberry Crater and other places. Where do the three of you see energy sources coming from at this point? If I can get an idea from you.
Yeah. Why Oregon Citizens Against the Pipeline is opposed to liquefied natural gas being imported from overseas. We are not opposed to natural gas. And in recent years, there's been discovery and development of abundant U.S. sources. So there's no shortage of natural gas. That as a bridge, I would see, I would hope solar and other forms would come online by that time, and that's the option, we'd go.
Quick follow-up, if I could. Mm-hmm. Last session, we passed a bill, I opposed it, to block the exploration of natural gas wells off the Oregon coast, which would create another source of domestic natural gas right here in Oregon. Would your organization be in favor or opposed to repealing that prohibition of searching for natural gas and energy sources off the Oregon coast?
I can only speak for myself, but I personally don't see that the impact to our Oregon coast is necessary. I think there's right now three major transmission lines proposed from the Rocky Mountains, and they're going to supply us with a great deal of gas, so I see no shortage and necessary option to go for the coast.
May I address some of your questions? I can't speak for the coalition itself, but I can speak personally. There are difficult choices that we make on all forms of energy. There's an old saying, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And the way I look at that is that we need to look at all renewable energy forms and then make the hard choice and weigh, which will have the greater impact on our environment and which will not. And so, we've been very active on the wave energy front because in Douglas County we certainly have the possibility of developing significant wave energy. We need to be cognizant and recognize that there are environmental difficulties that attach to everything we do, and we need to work those out. So I don't think it would be foolish of us to rule out renewable energy because of environmental concerns. We need to work on them in a way that will satisfy environmental concerns. But when I look at that compared to the overarching threat of carbon dioxide emissions, those pale in significance to that. So I'm more eager to make those personal compromises on certain problems on renewable energy than I am in terms of suffering from the carbon dioxide emissions. That's a personal perspective that I have, and it's not, we don't have an official position on our board itself. But, I recognize that everything you try with its geothermal or wave or what have you, is going to have some economic consequence, and we need to kind of address that and deal with that, and there may be compromises down the road. I know, for example, wind energy, people protest because it's off the coast and, you know, block the nice view and all this type of stuff, and these are the hard choices we need to make, and we just need to recognize the overarching large consequence of global warming and move forward as best we can.
Okay, I'm going to go for the next group. Thank you, folks, for coming up. Let's get some people in opposition here. Art Crino, and if I said it wrong, you can please correct me when you come up. And Todd Wynn are the two signed up in opposition.
Dr. Metzger, Vice President Starr, and other members of the panel. My name is Art Crino. I'm Tigard. I'm a retired electrical engineer. I'm a little bewildered by these bills that package pollutants with carbon dioxide. Back on the farm when I was a youngster, before I learned to spell photosynthesis, I was told carbon dioxide was our friend. We had a greenhouse. And carbon dioxide only has a minuscule effect on the temperature. The 11-minute DVDs that have been distributed to you takes you back to when the Vikings visited Greenland and prospered for a few hundred years, and then we went to the Little Ice Age. It's the sun that's doing it, and that's what that DVD points out. And I'm not the voice crying in the wilderness here. There's also a petition in front of you that has been signed by 32,000 scientists, 9,000 of them PhDs. The two paragraphs. First paragraph says that they recommend we not implement the 1997 Kyoto Protocol. And the second paragraph said we need more greenhouse gas, not less. And in view of the agricultural industry in Oregon, I would think that's an important point. The other point I'd like to make, when we talk about solar and wind, Germany is way ahead of us on it. They have determined that 15% is the limit of wind and solar of their total system. Now, we're fortunate in Northwest because we have hydro, so we can go somewhat higher here. Now, if you were to check with Bonneville, I hope you will, and ask them today what that number is. Now, they're scanning the whole Northwest plus British Columbia. And I believe the number today is around 25%. It might go to 30. But then when we get there, where do we go from there? Now, one of the things I visualize, as some of you sense, that our power rates are going to go up, supply and demand. And the poor people are going to get hurt, and we're going to drive more jobs out of the territory. I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Crino. Welcome.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Wynn. I am the Climate Change and Energy Policy Analyst and an economist working for Cascade Policy Institute, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy research organization in Oregon. First of all, we need to think rationally about Senate Bill 101. As Oregon grows economically and also in population, we'll need to be able to provide affordable and reliable power generation to meet this new demand. Eliminating new coal generation or the ability to renew contracts for coal could create some significant difficulties for utilities and their customers. Now, energy consumption in the state has increased 133% in the last 40 years, and this will certainly increase with an expected population of 4.5 million by 2025, which is almost more than a million than there is today. In Oregon, there's only a few power sources that can be used for baseload power generation. You have nuclear, which was banned in 1980 in the state, large-scale hydro, which many of the resources are tapped out or it's looked down upon because of salmon runs. Then you have coal and natural gas. If you eliminate coal, all you have is natural gas, which is subject to price volatility. It needs to be understood that wind, solar, and undeveloped wave energy resources are not going to be able to meet new demand, new baseload energy generation demand. in the future. Besides, this bill seems kind of like overkill. Senate Bill 838 already established a renewable portfolio standard, which requires utilities to use a certain amount of renewables in their actual electricity generation mix. And like the Pacific Coal representative already said, they aren't developing any new coal because of this uncertainty as far as carbon legislation is concerned. Now, on the question of affordability, the reality is that in 2008 alone, this is as a survey here in Oregon, 1 in 20 Oregonians have had their electricity cut off due to non-payment. Now, we can certainly expect this rate to increase as we see ever-increasing energy rates with less supply options or more expensive alternatives. I don't see it being possible to provide affordable and reliable energy without access to a diverse set of energy sources, which Oregon just doesn't have. You could be putting the state in a position to see brownouts, blackouts, and possibly thousands of Oregonians not able to pay their electricity bill. I simply cannot support Senate Bill 101.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Wynn or Mr. Creno? Okay, thank you both for coming. Okay, going back in order now on the pro side, Stephen Weiss and Jeff Bissonette.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Weiss. I'm Senior Policy Analyst for the Northwest Energy Coalition. As you'll see on our handout from our letterhead, we represent over 100 different organizations in the region, including several utilities, low-income groups, environmental groups, fishing groups, business groups, consumer groups, legal women voters, etc. So we're extremely broad, one of the largest organizations in the Northwest. I wanted to, we are in support of Senate Bill 101. We have been working with the with this group of utilities, environmental groups, and the Department of Energy and Public Utility Commission to come up with a bill that, that works for everyone. And I think, as you heard from PGE, that we are close and we hope to have agreement on all the issues. And hopefully by the end of this week, and we hope that you'll support that, that compromise. I wanted to just show you some background here because there's many misconceptions about how the energy system is connected in the region. The first graph on the top, first pie chart there is our regional emissions. So you know electricity is only about a fourth of the problem. Transportation's the biggest problem. Natural gas, only 10%, and then other, which is a lot of things, agriculture, cement, a whole bunch of other odds and ends go for the last 20%. If you take that 23% regional emissions and you in the second graph, and you see, well, where is our electricity coming from? Now, this is the region, not Oregon, but Oregon's actually a little heavier coal and a little less hydro, but this is a good starting point. You can see that coal is only, again, about 0.25% of our source of electricity, so we have quite a few other resources at current. But then you look at the emissions from electricity, the last graph, and you can see that coal is the big problem, 87% of our emissions. If we could slow or reverse, not use as much coal, we could reduce our regional emissions by almost a quarter. So this is where the problem is for the electric side. And then, of course, there's another problem on the transportation side. But for the electric side, this is coal is the big issue. If you turn over the page, you can see where our coal plants are and who owns them. We have about 7,000 megawatts in the region. PGE and PacifiCorp are Oregon utilities, and they own pieces of these plants. Many of them are quite old and will be reaching the end of their useful lives in the next 10-20 years. The reason that we support this bill is the older coal plants are the problem. SB 101 is the lowest cost way to phase them out as their useful lives are over. What this bill says is that you can run your plants now. Boardman, all the plants that are on this list would not be shut down. They'd be allowed to run until their useful lives are over. They're fully amortized. At that point, they would have to be phased out. SB 101 provides the time and certainty the utilities need to plan for retirement and to replace these, so it's not an instantaneous thing. They would have a few decades to plan for this, and in fact, that's one of the reasons why the utilities support this bill. It gives them certainty. Washington and California have passed similar laws, as you heard, so this having Oregon adopted prevents Oregon from being the dumping ground for coal power, because we would be the major population center left in the West. SB 101 provides a message to the other states, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, Nevada, and Utah. Many of their states are facing a debate of should they build more coal plants or should they build more wind, solar, and geothermal. This gives them a message that they're not going to have customers for their coal plants and that they should turn to renewable power. Finally, and this is extremely important now in hard times, on a per megawatt hour basis, investments in energy efficiency and renewables create 2 to 4 times more jobs than do investments in coal plants. If you want to go to a depressed county, pick a county where there's a coal plant. If you go to Wyoming, go to Montana, go to Utah, very, very high unemployment rate. They're not places that most people want to move to. Jobs are created with renewables, with energy efficiency. And we hope you'll support the compromise that we expect to have by the end of the week. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Jeff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, and mainly here to emphasize and echo that we, too, have been part of the work group working on the compromise bill. I think it's very close. The discussions are going well and are productive, and we hope to be back in front of the committee pretty soon with that compromise set of amendments, and we'll be able to explain to you in more detail how they work and how the utilities can explain how they will protect the utility, and we'll be able to explain how they protect ratepayers.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bissonnette. That was going to be my question for you. Since you do represent the interests of the ratepayers, maybe you could at least tell us what you're, as written, and what you're working on in terms of what is your basic, your major concern that you want to ensure before this committee moves forward that the ratepayers are being protected.
Sure. Mr. Chair, our overriding concern was stated by the utilities. We have the concern going forward of what the policy certainty is for the state, again, either on the federal level or on the state level. And so we are making investment decisions today that we're going to be paying for the next 50 years. And so coal is the cheapest resource today. It may not be in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and we need to have some certainty as to where the state is going sooner rather than later. And so this is a way to bring some of that certainty. So that's our overriding concern. I think the once we establish that certainty, it does drive research, it does drive development in other forms of energy generation, and does incent additional energy efficiency. All of that said, how a policy is implemented is, the devil is in the details, as they say. And so we try and think through, the what-ifs and try and account for that in statute as much as we can. And in rules where to make sure that for utilities anyway, that the PUC has the ability to say, oh, this is something we didn't think of. Either we need to create rules, we need more authority, or we have some sort of off-ramp. And so that's one of the things that that our representative in these negotiations has provided is, what are sort of the off-ramps, what are the authorities that are in place, what are some of the authorities that are needed, and how do we think some of that stuff through? So that's what we've been doing.
Thank you. Questions for either of our guests?
Senator Verger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the Northwest Energy Coalition, on the work group, are you one person representing this many people, or how does that process work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, we are a coalition of all these groups. Each of these groups has a member on our governing board, and so they, in a sense, hire me to represent them on these issues. I can't say that on every... we are an independent organization. They give us general direction. They can shut us down, but like any broad coalition, you have to work with the compromises, and that's what we've been able to do. On this legislation, we've been able to balance the interests of all these different groups. You can see PGE is one of the groups, EWEB, Seattle City Light, Sierra Club, the solar industry associations, low-income groups, and so on. They're able to give us direction that this is where they want to go toward a compromise that meets the interests of the environment, jobs, and Oregon. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair. I noticed many of the groups are not from Oregon.
Right. We're a four-state coalition, Senator.
You heard the testimony prior to yours from the Cascade Policy Institute. Would you respond to those? The testimony was that we're trying to get reliable and affordable power. You said no to nuclear. Hydro has the salmon issue. If you say no to coal, you only have natural gas, and then wind, solar, and wave would not meet the demand. So would you respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that leaves out one huge source of new energy, and that is energy conservation. Right now, the region as a whole is providing about two-thirds of its load growth with energy conservation, that is the new twisty light bulbs and new modern pumps and new insulation in people's homes and equipment. They're coming up with new standards for washing machines, for refrigerators. You'll be seeing in the next few years LED lights for parking lights. You're going to see standards on TVs are one of our biggest usage that will cut the usage of TVs, the energy usage. Tremendously. So one of the biggest sources of need is saving what we've got. That is about two-thirds of our, that will take care of about two-thirds of our, it takes care of two-thirds of our needs right now. We can accelerate that. The Power Planning Council expects that the new technologies will accelerate that. Basically, we think that energy efficiency can almost cover our entire load growth, and then the renewables that are already in our renewable portfolio standards and that the utilities are building right now can easily cover the gradual phase out of these coal plants. So it's not something that could happen tomorrow, but over 20, 30, 40 years, as renewables build up, as efficiency gets installed in people's homes and factories, we can easily meet the need. Our organization is releasing day after tomorrow a paper detailing this, and I can get it to members of the committee, show them how it can be done. And the job implications are tremendous, tremendous. These kind of projects really boost the economy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Okay, Sally from OEC North, Cheatham, and Brock, Kyle.
Mr. Chairman, while there's a break here, I wanted to point out that we do have written testimony from Ecumenical Ministries. It was placed at your spot on the dais, and we'll put that in the committee record.
Thank you, Mr. Stambridge. Please, go ahead.
My name is Sally Schillinger-Krause, and I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council. And you're not alone in not being able to pronounce my last name. I don't think anybody has ever been able to do it at first blush.
I just couldn't read it. I could have pronounced it. I couldn't read it.
Okay.
So.
I don't know that I have a lot to add to the testimony that you've already heard. today from the utilities and other members of the working group. But I would like to say that OEC is supportive of SB 101 as a key component to as a key component of Oregon's commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I'd also like to note that this seems to be one of those once rare but increasingly frequent instances where business and environmental interests are aligned, where you see business who has an interest in assuring that they're going to minimize their risk over the long term in generating resources that are exposed to higher carbon costs, and environmental interests that would like to reduce overall our greenhouse gas emission in the state of Oregon. There are a couple of areas that we would still like to see addressed in SB 101, and this includes contracts for investments in existing coal plants that would extend the lives of those coal plants. So basically, including this amendment would enable us to phase out an existing fleet of older plants that rely on inefficient technology and are responsible for a lot of emissions from the electricity sector. This is both critical for our short-term goal of achieving 10% below 1990 levels by 2020, and certainly for the longer-term goal of achieving at least 75% cuts below 1990 levels by 2050. The other thing I would like to add that I don't think has really been brought up by people up at the table is the fact that this is a part of a much larger package. So at the same time that we're talking about putting in place a standard that will reduce our reliance on coal, we're also talking about a number of other measures in the governor's package that will shift our generating resources to a large extent to energy efficiency, greater reliance on renewables, and other market mechanisms that will help us bear the costs of some of that shift. So I think that this particular standard does need to be taken into the context of the larger package that the governor is proposing. We are not part of the working group, but we are confident that the members of that working group will be able to work through some of the details and provide amendments that will create a much stronger bill overall and something that we can all agree to. So again, I would like to say that OEC does support this bill, and we look forward to seeing the next iteration. Thank you.
Ms. Bollinger-Cross, thank you very much. North.
Thank you. Chair Metzger and members of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, my name is North Cheatham. I come from Hood River, and I represent no particular interest group other than what I believe to be in the public's best interest. I've been here before. 2 years ago, the legislation, this legislature also wrestled with passing a greenhouse gas emission standard for power plants much like the one before you, based on emissions no higher than a combined cycle gas plant would emit. I supported it then, and let me tell you why it's in the public's best interest now to pass this bill in this session. If this legislature could pass SB 80, establishing the pilot programs necessary to implement carbon cap and trade consistent with the guidelines advocated by the Western Climate Initiative, passage of SB 101 may well be unnecessary. In that case, power generated from polluting power plants would carry a premium price that would reflect their true environmental costs. However, since there is no assurance cap and trade will be passed in this session, we must pass SB 101 to reduce additional pollutants from energy entering our airshed. This is in the public's best interest precisely because the public outcry over pollution emitted from the coal-fired Boardman plant. Where I live in the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area, this one plant is the greatest single source of atmospheric haze, greenhouse gases, sulfur dioxide, and mercury. Under the emission limits contained in this bill, no additional coal-fueled power plants could meet this standard without adding substantial carbon sequestration. Even with the substantial progress we've already made from renewables and conservation, our long-term power consumption needs require continued investment in electrical generation through at least 2030. Let's avoid the obvious disadvantages of approving additional sources of pollution just because the upfront capital cost of power produced from coal is less than from cleaner sources. Clean energy avoids negative environmental effects and adverse consequences to the health of our citizens. SB 101 requires no expenditure from the general fund. Please side with responsible economic sustainability and pass this bill. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Cheatham. Well, let's go to our next guest here first.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell, and I'm an advocate for Environment Oregon. And we advocate on behalf of our 30,000 members in the state and the public interest in protecting clean air, clean water, and open space. And we also support Senate Bill 101. There's a couple of reasons why. There's two problems we face going in the future with energy. And one is the issue of global warming. I think we all recognize the problem that we face there. And then the second is how do we provide energy in such a way that we won't negatively impact our environment. This bill will help us do that because we're looking over by 2030 of increasing our carbon in the atmosphere, just Oregon's contribution, about 20 million metric tons by 2030. This bill alone would reduce that, reduce our emissions by 13.4 million metric tons. So if we don't take this action, if we don't not allow coal plants to be built, there's no way we're going to be able to reach our goals for a state of reducing CO2 or reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. So this is a critical component of that, and we view it as part of the larger package as well for how we address global warming, including some of the other bills that are presented to us. So how are we going to provide this energy? It's been asked a few times already. We agree that we have to provide new energy sources. That is going to include solar, wind. Hopefully, we can provide some ocean power as well, if we site it correctly. But probably the best way we can do it is through energy efficiency. But it's going to take multiple approaches. So, with that, we urge you to pass Senate Bill 101. Obviously, there's some adjustments that we need to make for some amendments to align ourselves with Washington and California. But we certainly appreciate your time on this effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for any of our trio?
Yes. Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
Thank you all for coming today, by the way. And looking at the testimony earlier, obviously about, 65% of our current energy comes from renewables right now, 65%. So what I look at, and if you add nuclear in there, you're at 68% based off the chart we just got. So the question, the fear I have is that I see pressure not only on coal, and then we ask the opposition to liquefied natural gas, but then we also see pressure on clean energies like hydro and nuclear. So let me ask you, the three of you, this question. Where would the three of you be on a bill that would allow for the supersiting of both new additional hydro facilities and new nuclear facilities, since they don't produce any carbon? Where would the three of you be on those type of issues? If somebody came up with a proposed bill and said, we're going to allow for the supersiting of hydro and the new hydro plants and new nuclear, where would the three of you be on those pieces of legislation?
I'll answer for Environment Oregon. We feel that we have not resolved the issue for nuclear plants of how we deal with waste. Until we deal with waste, we cannot support nuclear energy because it undermines our long-term sustainability of both local regions and also the environment in a broader sense. But the most important factor, I think, in this is that we don't actually need those two sources. That energy efficiency, solar, diversified solar and wind energy, we'll be able to provide that energy based off our studies. Additionally, we do support micro hydro. That's another source of hydro energy, and we do support that approach.
Yeah. Let's kind of keep our answers brief. I know we asked the question, but I want to move on. So.
Yeah, I'll just take a brief shot at that. I think micro hydro is certainly one resource that we have available to us. But one of the issues about hydro is that one of the impacts of climate change in the Northwest will be reduced snowpack, which will of course affect our overall reliance on the hydro system. So I think we have to be really careful about how we expand future reliance on that if the overall resource is going to dwindle. Secondly, in terms of the nuclear issue, I think that besides the waste question, which has not been fully resolved, you also have immense costs associated with the siting and the building of new power plants. And this certainly poses a risk to ratepayers and customers of electricity, not only in the Northwest, but elsewhere in the state.
Senator George, Senator Metzger, and the panel. I wanted to address, first of all, the hydro question and then the nuclear question and add some other comments. I'll be brief.
Yeah, please.
First, with hydro, it may well be that we don't have to make that choice. The reason I say this is because we have a number of bills in this session, a dizzying number of bills that have been brought before the legislature by the governor that would drastically increase the conservation of buildings, that would, if approved, change the rate paying structure for suppliers of solar energy to a feed-in tariff, which would be tremendously stimulating for that business. We've seen a bill that would grease the skids of ocean power development. Don't ask me the numbers of these bills, folks. I get lost in numbers.
I do, too.
But at any rate, what I'm saying is that there is an entire package of bills here, and I don't know if anyone can really anticipate the true consequence of the conservation and additional generation capacity of those bills until we find out what's passed and what isn't. Now, the last thing, and I'll just be brief here, nuclear. Nuclear is compelling only because it does not release greenhouse gases. What I am concerned about is that in the rush to solve our greenhouse gas problem, that nuclear doesn't become the solution. I'll leave the proportion and the negotiation on nuclears to others. Thank you.
Thank all of you for coming. Okay, the last three people we have signed up are Suzanne, Lita, Lou, signed up for, Jim Carlock, come on up, signed up against, and John Chandler, who says he won't tell us if he's for or against it, he just wants to talk about it. So, this will be our final panel for today. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Suzanne Lita Liu. I'm the Senior Policy Advocate at Renewable Northwest Project. For those of you who might not be familiar with our organization, we are a coalition of public interest organizations, primarily consumer and environmental groups, and renewable energy companies. So the renewable energy side of our membership includes developers, manufacturers, all of the consulting groups that go along with that business, any other kinds of food groups that you might not be familiar with, like the Columbia Gorge Community College that trains WIND O&M staff in the Port of Vancouver that imports turbine parts into the Northwest. So it's a little bit about our organization. Our primary mission is to advocate for the expansion of the Northwest renewable energy resource potential. And as I'm sure many of you know, we were one of the lead groups that worked on SB 38. I think that you've heard a lot from other speakers today, so I'll be very brief. And I want to emphasize that first, our support for SB 101. We're looking forward to seeing what comes out of the conversation between the utilities and the consumer and environmental community, and we think that those conversations are a very positive development. In general, you know, we do believe that we need to be not only reducing our future resource portfolio carbon risk, which is what the utilities expressed today, but that at the same time we can actually significantly reduce those risks by increasing our renewable resource portfolio. Just a couple of key points that I thought that I think are important to highlight. The Northwest has incredible renewable energy resources: wind, solar, geothermal, wave. You know, we've got other resources like biomass. We have, obviously, hydro resources. And the purpose of this legislation and other legislation is to expand our new renewable energy resources. And we certainly have been doing that, especially recently. Right now in the Northwest, we have over 2,700 megawatts of renewable energy installed. And in Oregon specifically, that's close to 1,000 megawatts. In addition to that, we have an incredible pipeline of renewable energy resource projects in the works. So just for Oregon alone, we've got about 1,000 megawatts in the ground. We have another 2,300 megawatts in the pipeline. And for every project, an average-sized project is about 100 megawatts. We get 200 construction jobs, typically around a dozen or more full-time permanent jobs, and those are in rural communities that need those jobs most. Local tax benefits, state income tax benefits, local community development as a result of the construction and the operation in that area. So Oregon is seeing the economic benefits of renewable energy resources. In addition to that, Oregon consumers are getting the fuel benefit, or I should say the price benefits of long-term cost stability. Unlike other resources, renewables don't have price volatility like natural gas and coal, particularly with the way that carbon is going to be priced in the future. And on top of that, the primary fuel, the wind or the sun, that gets these resources to generate electricity is free. And so the primary cost for renewables is in the capital cost, unlike in traditional conventional sources where the primary cost is in the fuel. So consumers get a major benefit from that long-term price stability that we don't have with other types of resources. And finally, just to address, I think, Senator George's question about the cost of renewables, we're really involved in the state's renewable portfolio standard implementation right now. And what's interesting about that is they look at the price of renewables versus sort of the alternative. And in this case, the pretty common alternative, the standard alternative that we're discussing, is a combined cycle natural gas plant. And if you look at the long-term levelized cost comparison, that's dollar per megawatt hour for a combined cycle natural gas plant, in comparison to a wind plant, those numbers are actually coming out negative for wind, which means that in the past couple of years, wind, now clearly we've seen some variation in the price of natural gas now, for the past couple of years, wind has actually been less expensive than a combined cycle natural gas plant. So this is clearly of consumers' benefit, and that's industrial consumers, residential consumers across the board. So I'll just sum it up there, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We'll go to Mr. Carlock.
I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to testify to the committee.
State your name for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jim Carlock. I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Thank you.
I'd like to, first off, this whole bill is based on the presumption that we have a climate problem. I'm passing out, I've got like four handouts and a DVD.
that are all relevant to this subject. The first one is this yellow front one that has some New York Times articles. Did you know that in 05, somebody actually navigated the Northwest Passage between the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean? That was 1905, not 2005. 1932, prediction of melting polar ice caps, didn't happen. 1975, Newsweek, the cooling world, we're going to run out of food because of a coming ice age, didn't happen. The current predictions are probably not going to happen. Let's look at a couple quick climate facts. Both sides of the argument agree on the following two statements. Water vapor is the major greenhouse gas, not CO2. CO2, at maximum, is 30% of any greenhouse effect. Fact number two, we've all heard about the Antarctic ice caps, or ice cores, that show a strong correlation between temperature and CO2. What they don't generally tell you is that the temperature change happened first and the CO2 change happened second, therefore disproving CO2 as a driver of temperature in that particular historic record. Bottom of the second page, you'll find correlation between sunspot cycle and temperature is much better than between CO2 and temperature. That is a much more appealing theory as to what's going on with the current record. Why do we have the current panic going on? Let me read you a quote. I'm going to modify this just a little. I believe it is appropriate to have an overrepresentation of factual presentations on how dangerous Saddam is. Now, does that make anybody's blood boil that somebody got into war with a factual overrepresentation? The actual quote is from Al Gore, and it's an overrepresentation of how dangerous the climate change is. Same reaction from me. Now, sticking on the Al Gore subject, this handout documents nine errors that a British court of law found in Al Gore's popular movie, An Inconvenient Truth. Most of them are severe overrepresentations of the facts. A couple of them are just plain wrong. For instance, the Pacific Island being evacuated, I'm quoting the judge, there is no evidence of any such evacuation having yet happened. Now, along with this hysteria, we have also heard about scientists that have been squelched. I have a DVD here made by one of the scientists that has been squelched. Unfortunately, this scientist was squelched by Oregon's governor. Now, we have a Global Warming Climate Change Commission here in Oregon, and it just recently put out a report last week recommending that we trade, that part of this recommendation was that we trade carbon offsets. Well, golly gee, the chairman of this Global Warming Commission right here in Oregon happens to be president of a company that sells carbon offsets. If this were a scientist on the other side, this state would be screaming for his blood. Now, there is a way to cut CO2. Our short-term goal is a 40% cut of CO2. If you look at this page here, you'll find a pie chart and a numeric chart, both out of Oregon State documents as stated. These say that we currently, our current CO2 emissions, 42% of our current CO2 emissions come from electric generation. Simple solution, and you could do this in Senate Bill 100, ban all electric power generation except from nuclear. No CO2, period, end of problem. We don't have to have people rearrange their lifestyles. We don't have to talk about forcing people out of their cars. We don't have to spend millions of dollars re-insulating buildings, etc. All we have to do is tell the power companies, hey, build nuclear. We're all in favor of it. It's not going to cost anybody anything, and it will save money on electricity. France is already 80% nuclear. They're saving a lot of money. We have some states in this country that I believe are, I'm not sure, but I believe are above 50% nuclear. Nuclear works. It has a long proven track record. Chernobyl was an exception. It was a type of power plant that was banned in this country immediately after Second World War when we were finished with the wartime emergency. We recognize the danger of that style of plant, and we never use them for commercial power. The fact that Russia did is just unconscionable, and it's also unconscionable to blame the entire nuclear industry for that incident in Russia. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carlock.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, well, we'll see what Mr. Chandler wants to tell us about, and then we'll ask if there's any questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I didn't tell the staff where I was for or against the bill, Mr. Chairman, for several reasons. Number one, there's probably not all that many people who care where the home builders are with regard to greenhouse gas and electricity. And secondly, because what I want to talk about was the broader conversation that's taking place in this building using this opportunity that you've given us today with Senate Bill 101. I fully expect to be supportive of the amendments when they come back in front of you. I think the group that's working on those is obviously the people that actually understand the underlying issue. I think it's a good that they go off and have that conversation. I applaud them for it. With regard to the broader conversation, there's two things I wanted to mention to you. One, as you already know, there's another six or seven or eight different bills on this general topic working their way through various committees, both sides of this building. And I would encourage you, and I know you're doing this in your caucus meetings and your private discussions, to keep an eye on where those other bills are and how the concepts of this bill and the policies of this bill, however it gets amended, doesn't get too far ahead of any of the other efforts that are going forward. Senate Bill 80, we've been involved with the task force, the industry coalition has pulled together to look at Senate Bill 80, 2186, 79, and so on. There's going to be a good policy on climate coming out of this legislature. I believe there will be. Whether it looks like any of the bills currently on the table, I do not know. This bill and the concept of this bill are going to be part of that. Please make sure it fits into that broader discussion. Second point I want to make is this bill highlights an issue that I doubt we'll get to this session, but I would commend it to you for future sessions, and that is state government is not really set up. The agency structure of state government is not set up to handle an issue of the magnitude of climate change, or carbon reduction, or greenhouse gas reduction, or however you want to phrase it. We have very good people in very good agencies doing work at the best of their abilities, but there isn't any congruent way to make sure that what happens at the PUC, or a DOE, or a DEQ, or the Building Codes Division, or housing, or any of the other agencies that have legitimately some piece of this puzzle, coordinate their efforts. And we've talked about this in other bills and other sessions on water, on land use, on other issues where the failure of coordination or the lack of an overarching strategy isn't quite as dire. This is probably one where we want to pay attention to the structure. As I say, I don't expect it to happen this time, but when you see in the bill, Agency 1, with its own set of imperatives, its own leadership, its own governing structure, its own statutory authority, doing something that dramatically affects Agency 2, also with its own governing structure, its own legislative statements, and so on, you have a risk of conflict at worst and a lot of friction loss and tripping each other at best. I would commend to you, as you go forward discussing this session, thinking about how the state would organize itself to respond to this issue, perhaps for 2011, perhaps for one of the sessions that may happen between now and 2011. But I believe, as a practitioner of this in this building for quite a while, something has going to have to happen on agency restructuring in order to move this issue forward expeditiously and with a minimum of fuss. Glad to take any questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, excuse me. Please buy a new house. Yeah, today. Thank you very much.
I understand there's a sale. Questions for any of our guests? Yes, Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'd just like to make some comments to each of the three of you. Thank you very much for bringing up the other bills. I think that's an extremely important point, that we follow them and that even maybe some of us talk about them at the same time that they're trying to get through the process. I'd like to address to you your comments about WAVE. I don't want you to count it too quick. We've not been able to get the buoys in the water. Right. And so the research may be a moot question. So when you're talking about it, just always kind of preface it with potential. And then to Mr. Carlock, I want to thank you very much for coming today. I hope that you were very comfortable in making your presentation. Thank you for your handouts. Good policy is never made when everybody at the table agrees. It's always where we have different points of view, and I thank you very much for yours.
You're very welcome. And I did forget to mention a website called Sustainable Oregon has all these facts documented on it. Sustainable Oregon. And once again, thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Any other questions?
.com.
.com. Okay. Thank you very much for coming. Well, colleagues, so we had our introduction to 101. We will be bringing this bill back, but at least we have a beginning spot for that. And I would be very interested, as those who are working on amendments to this bill, keep in contact with the members prior to our next meeting. And then one other question that, since I know they're in the room, or at least listening, but I think it's going to be important, too. I know this bill is primarily directed at future coal. That's been said on a number of occasions by parties. And I know in at least all my discussions with the utilities, they have no intention whatsoever to do any more coal. So, I'd also like to hear kind of why the bill is important when everyone seems to believe that that there's no way they're going to do it. So, I mean, I think that context will be important. Would you tell us about Wednesday, which hopefully will be light?
Mr. Chairman, we have three work sessions on bills that you have heard previously. Would you like to know more?
That's okay. We won't, because we all have heard them, but we just have the work sessions. So I will, depending on how we deal, we should be able to, I'm hopeful to be out within 30 minutes on Wednesday. So if you wanted to plan some other things, I just wanted to give you a heads up that you should be able to do that. Okay? With that, we're adjourned.